Les colloques du Collège de France.
So as you could see, actually, this production of SEM raises quite a number of ethical issues, which will be actually discussed in the afternoon, and in particular, perhaps for those scientists interested in the development of what is considered to be the most human-specific trait when compared to other mammals, that is our brain. And indeed, one can hardly imagine to keep these embryos model growing in culture until the time they will start to differentiate and connect in this extraordinary collection of neurons that will make us what we are. And therefore, this important knowledge will have to derive still from alternative systems, such as organoid and mini brains. And to tell us about this, I'm super happy to welcome Barbara Treutlein. Barbara is professor at the Department of Biosystem Science and Engineering at the Zurich Polytechnic School, but based in the extension in Basel. Barbara Treutlein is a world expert in developmental biology, but treated in a quantitative manner. As such, she's using brain organoids to try to produce and compute cellular parameters that will eventually allow her to reconstruct the way these structures are built, not only in a normal situation, but also by using organoids derived from patients suffering from severe developmental disorders. There again, as for the previous speakers, Barbara is leading this very field, and I'm very grateful that she accepted to come today. Barbara, please.
Thank you very much, Denis. And also thanks to Alfonso and Jacob for really great presentations and really setting the stage here for my presentation. I will check if my... On understanding human brain development with organoids and single-cell analysis. And I want to take a step back. You heard a lot about embryo development, embryonic tissues, embryonic cells and states. And I want to take a step back and think about the human body and how our body is composed of an extreme diversity of tissues and organs that function in very different ways, but that are also structurally extremely different. And you see here H&E stainings of different tissues of the human body, and they look extremely different because of the underlying diversity of cell types that you find in these tissues. So there are, of course, extremely different cell types in the brain that give the brain its function to compute all the input and give us our cognitive abilities, and these are different from, for example, the heart muscle cells that allow the heart to pump, and the epithelial cells that create a barrier in the intestine and allow us to absorb nutrients. And of course, all this cell type diversity is established during development. And you saw in the first two talks these very extremely important early stages of human development, and here's again this Carnegie collection that is seen. And so you heard a lot about these very early stages, but of course as we move through development, these organs get formed and the cell types emerge and specify from initially this one stem cell into different developmental intermediates until they reach their potentially final, and of course still subject to to change even later on, but kind of final differentiated cell type. And of course, what is very important, or how cells know what to become and why, when and how to change their identity over this course of development, is driven by the genes that are being expressed at any point in time during this developmental process. And of course, one can extend this to the chromatin that actually regulates and the epigenome that regulates which genes are expressed at which point in time. But knowing which genes are expressed, we know in what kind of state the cell is in along this developmental path. And we can also extract from the genes that are being expressed and utilized by the cell at a given time what might be the state or the function of a cell. And so it is extremely exciting these days to focus on human developmental biology and human organogenesis, because we can model this in vitro. And you saw from the previous talks that we can model the very onset of embryogenesis, the earliest steps of human development in vitro. But we can actually also kind of skip these very early steps and try to give these pluripotent stem cells or induced pluripotent stem cells the cues to very fast go into a certain germ layer and adopt the fate of cells of a given organ. And so, I mean, what we can do is to give cues to do differentiation into all kinds of different human cell types in a two-dimensional culture. But of course, what is most exciting to us is the self-organizing capacity of these stem cells, aggregating them, providing them the signaling cues to then differentiate in a 3D, 3D tissue into these organ-like in vitro tissues. And that we call organoids. So as compared to embryoids or embryoid models, these organoids model organ development. And this is very exciting because we can not only mimic development of a given organ for a healthy individual, but we can do this for diseased individuals that might have mutations in their genome that lead to developmental disorders or other types of diseases. And what we can also do is, for the same human individual from which we derived the initial stem cells, we can grow many tissues, and for the same individual do time course measurements. We can assess this tissue at various time points. Even though with every experiment we might use up the tissue, we can grow more of it. And of course, the tissue then has the specific genome of the individual from which we derived the stem cells. So we can really do individualized modeling of development. We can also genetically modify, manipulate these tissues and do screens. And so overall, these organoids are extremely exciting. And here, just giving you some examples of how they look. I will focus a lot on these brain organoids that model development of the human brain, but there are all kinds of different systems available for all kinds of different organs. So we can also mimic intestine development, blood vessel development, heart development, liver, retina development, lung, and skin development, and many others derived from these pluripotent stem cells in these organoids. And you can see here in stainings with different cell types labeled with different colors that these are complex tissues. They are not just a stochastic aggregate of cell types, but actually the cell types are organized in an architecture that really mimics in many aspects the architecture of the tissue that you would find in a human body. And I should say that it's not just the cell types that compose these organoids and their relative location, so the architecture of the tissue, that makes these organ-like, but they also are called organoids, especially if they mimic also some functional aspects of the tissues they try to model. And here, just showing some examples for these cardioids. This is from Sasha Menjan's lab, where they actually undergo the synchronized beating that you would expect from a heart, where the cardiomyocytes undergo these contractions in synchronized ways, or brain organoids that, and I will get more into that, that can actually have neurons that fire action potentials, which is what you would expect from a functioning brain tissue. And so we focus a lot on human brain development. And when we look at this over the course here of 9 months, it starts actually extremely simple as first a neural plate that folds into the neural tube. And so from this neural tube, you then undergo a lot of morphological changes to really form this tissue that is extremely folded and complex at the end. And this is, of course, in a newborn. It will further grow and further develop even post-birth. But when we focus on these early stages, what we have is this neural tube. So it's a vesicle. There are initially three primary brain vesicles. And along the anterior-posterior axis, this tissue gets patterned due to morphogen gradients into forebrain, midbrain, and hindbrain. And this further subdivides into five secondary brain vesicles and further subdivisions into these different brain regions that at the end compose our central nervous system. And all this is driven by this very precisely orchestrated, spatiotemporally orchestrated secretion of morphogens and organizers that form along this neural tube. And if we zoom in this tissue, we have neuroepithelial cells that are initially forming this neural tube. They get patterned, as I said, through these morphogens and start to become radioglia cells that are the stem cells for all the neurons and glial cells in the brain. And they then differentiate into neurons that migrate up. And later on, after neurogenesis, they form glia, meaning the astrocytes, the oligodendrocytes, the adult stem cells at the end, as well as ependymal cells. And so all of this, these processes of pre-neurogenesis, neurogenesis, and gliogenesis is what we can model in human neuroorganoids. And this is one of the major systems we are using, where we take these pluripotent stem cells, we aggregate them into embryoid bodies, but now instead of allowing them to form all germ layers and trying to mimic gastrulation and so on, we try to really fast go to a neuroectodermal tissue, so we induce neuroectoderm, and then allow this neuroepithelium that forms to differentiate by itself. And what we see is that lumen form, these mimicking these vesicles that I talked about, and now here in a two-month-old organoids, a cross-section through this tissue, we can appreciate in magenta these radioglia progenitors that form, and they really line the ventricular regions as is expected, and neurons that are early born here in these cortical regions labeled by CTIP2, these are excitatory cortical neurons, and they are found on the basal side, so when the progenitor cells differentiate, these cells are migrating up and form this cortical plate, as would be expected. And actually, if we compare an organoid cortex-like region with a primary human developing cortex, you can see the similarity in this architecture. So this is exciting. We can mimic these steps of kind of the formation of these vesicles and neurogenesis and gliogenesis, but we need also the right tools to understand what these cells are doing and to potentially in a perturbation, in a disease, then understand what is different in the disease case compared to the control. And here we have been trying to push technologies that allow us to really understand these tissues in detail and with high information contact on a single cell level. So we can apply different single cell technologies, and you have heard in the previous talks a lot about single cell RNA sequencing, so this is also what we can do to these organoids. We can dissociate them into single cells. I mean, even though the tissue looks very nice, we actually disrupt it. We take individual cells, we put them into droplet microfluidics, we isolate individual cells, amplify their RNA, their transcriptome, and then sequence it with next-generation sequencing. And with this, we can learn which gene is expressed in any of these cells that we captured. And when we do this, we can get plots like this, where each dot here is actually a single cell, and the single cells are arranged based on their transcriptome similarities. So we are actually starting with pluripotent cells here. So here we profiled from day zero to 4 months of development. And we start from pluripotent cells and go through these stages, transcriptomically different stages of neuroectodermal, neuroepithelial cells. And then we go into these neural stem cells that then give rise to these different branches that are actually the neurons. And I'm marking here different neuron types, cortical excitatory neuron, ventral telencephalic inhibitory neurons, we have hindbrain and midbrain neurons. We also have astrocytes that develop, especially at later time points, at 4 months. And so we can, with these technologies, really understand what are the cells doing, how do they differentiate, and what are the cell types that at the end compose the tissue. And actually, just to explain, how do we manage to annotate this, to find out which cell is what? We look at the expression of genes, for example, FOXG1, which marks here in the mouse in situ the telencephalon, and we can see this expressed in these two branches, meaning that these are both telencephalic. And then within the telencephalon, we can distinguish between NeuroD6 marking the cortex, DLX5 marking the ventral telencephalon, and this is exactly what we see here. On the right branch, it's the cortex. On the left branch, it's the ganglionic eminence. And so this is how we can actually annotate these graphs. So with single-cell technologies, single-cell RNA sequencing is extremely powerful to understand what genes are expressed and what are the cells, what is their cell type identity. But what we can also do now that we culture these brain organoids in vitro, we can actually, what we can't do for any primary, we can grow them also in controlled environments in the microscope and really try to directly image how they develop live or over a long time. And this is not easy for these human brain organoids because they develop extremely slow. I mean, it takes our brain more than, more than the 9 months to develop. They become fast, very large, and optically dense. And so we need ways to deal with that. We actually, in this case, use a mosaic labeling approach where most cells in the tissue are unlabeled and only a fraction of 5% are actually labeled with different cellular labels. And so when we do this, we can then appreciate here 95% are unlabeled. So you see really just the labeled 5%, but you can directly now watch how each individual cell is contributing to these different ventricular regions, how cells are differentiating, migrating, changing their morphology from initially very round cells to very elongated neuroepithelial cells that then further differentiate into more complex even neurons. And we can, of course, quantify these movies. We can track each cell. We can quantify when does a cell division happen, when does a cell divide into two daughter cells, and we can then label kind of the time of the cell, how new is the cell, or how long has it been around in the organoid. And from all this together, we can actually establish a lineage tree of the cells that compose these brain organoids. And of course, something like that would not be possible with primary tissue. You need this in vitro model. And I should mention that we can not only image one at a time, we can image 16 at a time. So it really gives you a way of also doing statistics and looking at consistency. And here you see now cross sections, whereas the other ones were maximum projections. So you, in these cross sections, through 16 organoids imaged at the same time, you can see how all of them form these vesicles and have the neuroepithelia form that then start to thicken over time. So now, kind of taking these organoids together with these single-cell methods that I showed you, what can we do? And what we can do is actually try to now really understand different aspects of human brain development. We can try to understand developmental mechanism underlying the cell type specification in these tissues. We can try to understand disease by, for example, growing them from diseased individuals, from patients with neurodevelopmental disorders, and generally perturb the tissue to mimic gene mutations. But we can also, and this is what Denise even mentioned in the beginning, we could try to understand maybe what makes the human brain different from that of other species. And here most interesting is maybe our closest living relative, the chimpanzee, where we have pretty much no access to early brain development unless we would maybe be able to also model that in vitro. So giving you now just some examples, here you can see how we, in collaboration with Silvia Capello's lab, modeled a neurodevelopmental disorder that leads to malformation of the brain. So whereas in the healthy individual, there is white matter in the normal brain, and in these individuals with periventricular heterotopia, you have nodules of gray matter, so nodules of neurons that are not migrating in the right way during development, but then found at these ventricles here at the wrong place. And so having these misplaced neurons in the patients lead to epilepsy, can lead to developmental delay and other other cognitive disabilities. And so what we did here is then to use iPS cells from control patients and from patients with mutations in two genes, DUX1 and FAT4, that lead to this heterotopia phenotype, and modeling them their brain development in the dish. And if we look at the organoids at the end, you can now see again these here labeled are the neurons, which are found basally, and in dark here are these progenitor regions. And you can see that in the patient organoids, you have in the organoids these nodules of MAP2 positive neurons that are at the ventricular surface where normally you wouldn't find neurons. So we can actually really model the onset of such a developmental malformation in the brain, which is exciting because you would not have access to that. This is prenatal very early in first, second trimester of development. And then, of course, we can apply the single cell sequencing method and try to understand what are these neurons that are mislocated, what is their differential expression signature, what genes are dysregulated, and how could we potentially in the future maybe even use this in some therapy way. I mean, we did not go there. This is extremely difficult for such early neurodevelopmental disorders, but it is even interesting just from a basic research point of view to understand why a subset of neurons fail to migrate, even though all cells, actually, I should mention, have the mutation in this case. We can also try to go towards higher throughput with these perturbation studies, where we can not only have the line from one individual patient with the mutation, but we can introduce into the iPS cells with which we start the organoid culture a lot of different gene mutations. And so here we use then viruses to bring guide RNAs into these iPS cells that would recruit the Cas9 CRISPR enzyme to mutate and to scar certain genes. And we do this in a way where each cell then has on average, every cell has a different guide RNA that targets a different gene, so that in one cell we knock out gene 1, in the other cell we knock out gene 2, in the third cell we knock out gene 3. And so we have these mosaic organoids with different genotypes where we can understand now the role of these genes during brain development in an organoid as a kind of test tube. And so we then use at the end single cell transcriptomics to read out which gene was perturbed in which cell, but we also can from the single cell transcriptomics learn what was maybe an effect of the perturbation. And so we did this in two contexts. We on one hand knocked out in such high throughput way transcriptional regulators of development, and in the other study, we actually focused on disease-associated genes, in this case, risk genes for autism spectrum disorder, to understand what is the role of these genes. And I just want to guide through some of the data here. So for the perturbations of these developmental regulators, we targeted transcription factors, which are expressed during cortex development, and we would then, in this mosaic fashion, as I have explained, knock out the transcription factors. When we then sequence at the end a two-month-old brain organoids, we can identify again these progenitor cells and neurons of the different brain regions, the dorsal and ventral telencephalon, as well as the mid and hind brain, but we can also detect which gene was perturbed in which cell. And then we can ask, does the knockout, the deletion of any of these genes lead to a loss or a gain in a certain cell type? And so in this case, for example, we could see that a lot of these transcriptional regulators, when knocked out, we lead to a depletion of cortical cells. So these are then kind of regulators of cortex development, whereas other genes, when they were knocked out, led to an enrichment of cortical development. So it could be they are actually repressing cortex development or promoting these other regions to develop. And so when knocked out, now we have more cortical cells. And this is just how the data looks. For example, GLE3 was really leading to a strong depletion of cortex identity when knocked out, whereas HES1 led to an enrichment in cortical cells. And So we just followed up on this GLE3 gene, which is a well-known mediator of sonic hedgehog signaling, and we could also, in kind of a clean isogenic knockout line, where every cell has the GLE3 knockout or every cell is a wild-type cell, we could confirm that in the wild-type we have cortex developing here in red, and in two different knockout lines you don't get any cortex. So this is just an example how you can actually use these organoids to really understand the role of genes during development. And I should mention that in the mouse studies have been performed really seminal work looking at the role of GLE3 during brain development in the mouse, and it was shown that a knockout of GLE3 leads to a malformation of the cortex, and actually ventral DLX2 positive cells are found in these cortical regions where normally you would not find DLX2. So it was shown that GLE3 is important for cortex development, but now we can say also in these human tissues, and actually shown, modeled in these organoids, GLE3 is essential to make cortical neurons. And in the other case, in the case of this autism risk gene project, we knocked out 36 autism risk genes in mosaic fashion in these brain organoids. And what we could see is actually that there was really a common effect of these perturbations, where a lot of the genes that are linked to autism, when knocked out, led to a lowering of the amount of excitatory neurons in the cortex and an increase in inhibitory neurons. So there was a disbalance of neuron types that emerged in the cortex of these organoids. And we could actually see that a lot of the risk genes, autism risk genes, are linked through a gene regulatory network where they have really co-regulation and not just these risk genes, but also the genes that were perturbed in the knockout. They all somehow came together in a subnetwork, which indicate that there is that these genes are not fully separate. They are actually controlling each other and linked in gene regulatory space. And so it makes sense they lead to a similar phenotype when perturbed. So I showed you how we can understand more about the role of genes during development by itself, but also try to look at diseases. But I mentioned also this evolutionary aspect. And so, of course, the brain is a very interesting system to look at when we try to compare us to other species, because it's known that we have a much expanded cortex, we have larger neuron number and synaptic density and enhanced cognitive abilities over our closest living relative, the other great apes. And of course, even though chimps also draw and can do art, of course, there's quite a difference in the outcome between humans and chimp. And so we were curious, can we actually grow chimp organoids? There shouldn't be nothing speaking against that, being able to grow the organoids of other species. It's possible for mouse and human. So we generated chimp iPS cells from chimpanzee fibroblasts and chimpanzee blood cells, and then just used the same protocol we use for human cells to generate brain organoids. And this is actually now a chimpanzee organoid of Sandra of the Leipzig Zoo. And we can see that within these organoids, we see the same architecture of PAX6 positive radioglia progenitors and these CTYP2 positive excitatory neurons. And comparing the tissues just based on these stainings, actually we didn't see major differences, at least in these relatively early organoids up to 4 months of development. So now we can apply our single cell technologies, our single cell RNA sequencing method, also to these chimpanzee organoids. And here you can now see how those develop from pluripotency up to 4 months of development. And we can also see this kind of very similar differentiation from pluripotency. And here you can see now the expression of certain genes in the human graph and in the chimp graph. And you can see pluripotency marker of these neural stem cells, a marker of cortical neurons, and a marker of ventral telencephalic neurons. And you can see this is very similar. So now we wanted to actually use this to compare these cells. How are the cells in the human organoid different from the cells in the chimp organoid? And we decided to compare these cortical cells that we find in both organoid systems. And we don't just want to take the bulk of cortical neurons here and compare them, but really try to match the matching developmental state of the cells. So this is what we did here for kind of the human developmental trajectory into cortical neurons from pluripotency compared to the chimp developmental trajectory from pluripotent cells to the cortical neurons. What we actually could see is that transcriptionally they match very well early on, but when we get to the later stages, we could see that the human cells were less mature than the chimp cells. So this kind of going back to these graphs would mean that within 4 months, human neurons mature less than chimpanzee cells. So in 4-month-old chimpanzee organoids, we had much more mature neurons than we had in 4-month-old human organoids, which was a very interesting observation, this kind of delayed maturation in humans. It also makes sense if you consider that a chimp baby is born and the gestation time is not very different, and they can grab onto their mom, they can move around, whereas a human baby is very is incapable of all these behaviors when it's born. So it makes sense in a way that human neurons mature less fast. And of course, there is an idea, and this is just kind of an idea. We have no data to show this, that they take more time, but then you also can establish more complex connectivity patterns, and also the neurons have then at the end more complex morphologies than in the chimpanzee. But after having matched now the corresponding stages, we can also ask, are there genes that are different in humans than in chimpanzee? And we could identify genes that had a very specific expression profile, for example, in neural progenitor cells, in intermediate progenitors, or in neurons, in the human organoids, cortical cells, compared to chimp and macaque that we grew also as an outgroup in parallel. And so now one can, of course, dive into these genes and try to understand what is their role, how do they maybe lead to a different cellular or tissue phenotype at the end. And we could see that the genes that were differentially expressed were involved in very diverse processes, from proliferation to the neurite outgrowth, neuronal migration, to really more mature functions of synaptic transmission and so on. So I showed you how we can use brain organoids to understand mechanisms of development, disease, and also evolution. But I also want to use kind of the last quarter of my talk, let's say, to show some limitations of these organoid systems. And so here, for example, what you see is 7 different brain organoids with just slicing them and looking at the DAPI. So this just shows density of nuclei. And you see that each one of them looks different than the other. Of course, in our human brain, if you compare one to the other, there is much less variability than you see here. And of course, none of these really look like a human brain. And so there is this question, how well do organoids model human brain development? I showed from stainings, they are similar. We find the same genes that we expect, but how similar are they, and what is maybe missing? And of course, this was mentioned throughout, there are these atlases that are generated with single-cell transcriptomics, where we can really say these are the cells and they're the cell states we find in a given tissue. And this has been generated, for example, for the developing human brain by Sten Linnerson's group, for example. So can we somehow also have such an atlas for the organoids and then make comparisons, really quantitative comparisons, to understand is there something missing? Have we made all neuron types at the stage we expect in the organoids, or have we not made all of them yet? And so for that, we actually took all the papers that have been published with single-cell transcriptomic data on brain human brain organoids, which is many of them, and put them together into an integrated atlas to have all this data collected in one place. And this is how this atlas looks. Well, now we have all the data, single-cell transcriptomic characterization of human brain organoids collected in one place, where we see how pluripotent cells are differentiating through progenitor stages, non-telencephalic and telencephalic progenitor stages, to different neuron types. Also astrocytes, oligodendrocytes, precursor cells, and so now we have all of this in one place, and we can now say, how does this atlas of these organoid cells compare to an atlas of primary human brain cells, which is, as I mentioned, this atlas, Braun et al. Atlas from the Linnerson lab. And so we mapped the organoid cells to the primary atlas, and we can calculate an enrichment or depletion score. So everything here on this is the primary atlas, primary human brain atlas. Everything that's blue is well covered by organoids, but the red aspects are not well covered by organoids. And something that directly jumps out are these islands here, which are actually different non-neural cell types. So this is vascular cells, immune cells, erythrocytes, that we simply don't have in these brain organoids where we specify neuroectoderm. The neuroectoderm doesn't give rise to the vasculature, also not to the microglia that are the resident immune cells in the brain and other macrophages. So we don't have them in the tissues. But also if you look at neuron types, we have some underrepresented regions. We don't make so many thalamus, midbrain, or certain hindbrain regions. There we have not yet really made them in vitro, or at least we have not yet profiled them with single-cell RNA-seq from these organoids. So there is more work that needs to be done that goes really towards this next generation of brain organoid models, where we need to have immune cells in the brain. We need to try to have a vasculature to allow them to mature further and have also this blood-brain barrier mimicked. And we also need to better control their identity and ideally shape and the regionalization. And so, of course, we and others in the field are currently actively working on this, on these different aspects of bringing them further, bringing the organoids, brain organoids, to the next level. So one can derive microglia-like cells from pluripotent stem cells, giving them the right cues. So they derive from these primitive macrophage precursors. And then what we simply do is co-culture a brain organoid with a lot of microglia. And what they do is, what we noticed and others as well, is that they actually by themselves migrate into the tissue, similar to them infiltrating during early brain development. And then you have these here now green IBA1 positive cells that kind of tile the brain organoid tissue. And so you have these microglia-like cells now in the brain tissue. Towards the vascularization, there are actually very exciting models out there to mimic blood vessel development. And you can see snapshots stained here over time, how after in this case, defining mesoderm, lateral plate mesoderm, to then differentiate endothelial cells and mural cells from these. And these are tissues that really undergo sprouting. You see here how this network of endothelial cells that is developing is migrating into the matrix and sprouting. and one can stain them, one sees lumen. It's not just endothelial cells, but also the mural cells, pericytes, smooth muscle cells that support the vascular structures, and we see tip cells. And also here, of course, single-cell transcriptomics can give us an idea of what are the cell states in these tissues. And yeah, we see exactly that from these early mesodermal progenitors, we acquire both endothelial cell fate as well as mural cell fate, including pericytes, smooth muscle cells, and others. And so this is one model to generate human blood vessels in vitro, and we tried actually co-culturing them with brain organoids to see do they, vascularize the brain tissue. This for us did not work out, but we still ask, can we introduce in other ways vasculature or at least endothelial cell networks into brain organoids? And an approach that worked was to actually, instead of having these blood vessel organoids infiltrate co-cultured with the brain organoids, we specified with transcription factor overexpression in these developing brain organoids a fraction of the cells into endothelial cells. So ETV2 is a master regulator of endothelial cell fate. One can grow brain organoids and have a subset of the cells with an inducible ETV2 transgene, induce ETV2, and this makes them actually acquire endothelial cell fate, here shown in green with PCAM1. And one can also image that. So here in one can soon see how in green these endothelial cells or these cells where we induce ETV2 start to undergo really different morphological and migration behavior than the magenta cells that form the neural tissue. And of course, just having endothelial cell network in a brain organoid doesn't help. These endothelial cells are not really healthy. They are not perfused. We have no flow. Eventually, one wants to somehow perfuse these networks. And this one can try to achieve by placing them on a microfluidic vascular bed that can be generated also from endothelial cells derived from pluripotent stem cells, which would then look like this, where you have a brain organoid with endothelial cells within networks within the tissue, but then anastomosing with this vascular bed to then be able to perfuse it. And yeah, we are making the first progress there, and it's really areas of active research in the field to try to achieve this. Here we have these endothelial kind of networks that we perfuse from the vascular bed with an antibody for CD31, and you can see that the vascular network is labeled, means that the antibody actually reached these endothelial cell tubes. And so with this, I showed you how we and others in the field try to further equip these organoids with additional features that are missing currently, such as immune cells, vasculature, and I didn't show this, but also to try to control their shape and identity better to potentially reach a stereotypic development of human brain tissue and a better long-term maturation and recapitulation of interlineage crosstalk. And I want to mention that this is not work from our lab, but it was shown in Sergio Pasca's lab that indeed these organoids have an extreme potential. So what he did was to not leave these cortical organoids, in this case, in vitro, in the Petri dish, but actually engrafted into a rat brain. And once it's engrafted in the rat brain, it actually you achieve the immunocompensation and vascularization right there, because red endothelial cells, red vasculature will infiltrate this tissue. You will have microglia of the red going into this tissue. And so you have now a human brain organoid tissue that is in a more native environment and gets vascularized and gets all the stimuli it would get in vivo. And what they showed is that after transplantation, actually the neurons, and you see here a human cortical organoid-derived neuron, but after transplantation, how it increases in size and complexity over the in vitro neuron. So clearly in vitro, we don't give all the cues they would need, and in vivo, even if it's in a rat brain, they are way more mature compared to in vitro. And actually, this movie I showed in the beginning was from neurons after transplantation. In vitro, we don't see the exact same behavior yet. But it shows that these organoids have the potential, and actually, in this case, they even controlled neurons optogenetically within the organoid, and it induced behavior changes, which was licking in the rat. So even using these human neurons, you can control the behavior of the rat. And of course, this brings up a big debate of where is kind of the where should be a limit of this type of research, and what is actually the ethical, what are the ethical issues with brain organoids? Are they conscious? What is their moral status? And all these kind of questions. I'm not the ethicist that answers these questions, but I think it's definitely important to think about it. But as Alfonso said, he's happy that the gastroloids don't have the brain because this makes it easier. I'm actually happy that currently with our work of organoids, these brain organoids in vitro, I don't have the surrounding, and I'm so far we have not transplanted them into animals, and so of course they don't reach their full potential, but I think I still showed that we can do a lot with them nevertheless, and it definitely needs to be an active discourse with the public, with the regulatory authorities to say how far can one bring this type of research, how far can one mature brain organoids in vitro. And of course, these questions to be addressed with organoids, that you know, is true for any of the other organoid types, it is not limited to brain. Of course, you can study these interesting developmental disease and evolutionary questions also in the other organoid systems. And with this, I'm at the end, and I want to acknowledge my team that is really amazing to work with, our collaborators and our funding sources, and you for your attention, and I'm happy to take questions.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.